Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today we're going to start our show talking about an important time in history and also philosophy, and we're going to talk about it with Joseph Stewart. He's the program chair of history. He's a fellow of Catholic studies at the University of Mary. He's been there for 10 years, and he has a new book we're going to talk about. Joseph, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me.
The book is Rethinking the Enlightenment, Faith in the Age of Reason. And Joseph, let's start first with a definition of the Enlightenment. What was it? When did it take place? Who did it affect?
Sure. Yeah. So this was a major cultural movement of the 1700s, just a really exciting time of scientific discovery and research and the enthusiasm over the possibility of improving human life in even just little ways, like Benjamin Franklin and wanting to pave streets to get rid of the mud, or the invention of steam power. It was the time when the life of the cities of Europe started all coming on, and so the people's experience of even nighttime would have been illuminated for the first time really in history, and that gives multiple layers of meaning to the whole idea of the Enlightenment.
So you've got what would have been a very strong faith tradition, lots of powerful church influence on society, and at the same time you've got the elevation of science based on empirical evidence, and ultimately these things kind of meet each other, and there's a bit of tension, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, there's tension, and often what gets remembered about the Enlightenment is that tension, and we sort of read back some of our own unhappiness with either science or religion back into the time period. But in my research, what I found in other historians too is that a lot of religious people of faith, both Christians and Jews, in the 18th century were also scientists. And so they found very interesting ways that I tried to study in this book to bring their faith and their science together.
So why did you want to write the book to rethink the Enlightenment?
Yeah, I think it's partly what I've already hinted at, which is this idea that we remember the Enlightenment often as a time of being against religion. And so then that translates into our own attitudes to today. We have, you know, different parties or different interest groups and, you know, religion against science. But when we rethink it, when we go back and actually study the Enlightenment on its own terms, and we realize all the ways that that Christian people interact with the Enlightenment, including who's known as the Enlightenment Pope, Pope Benedict XIV, which we can say more about him later. But when we realize that, we realize, wow, the Enlightenment is actually much more interesting than we've come to normally understand it.
And this period in history is extremely important to at least a few countries. The United States, of course, we had a revolution around this time, and France had their own revolution and their reign of terror that came with it. So what was the authority or the governance, if you will, at that time that caused these tumultuous changes?
Yeah, so The different revolutions of the age are very fascinating. American Revolution, French Revolution. And I think what's often forgotten is the extreme difference between them. We just sort of often tend to lump them together. But the French Revolution was really became quite anti-religious, anti-Christian, especially in the middle period of it, and it was responding to a whole period when the absolute monarchs and the kings had sort of allied with the church and kind of became quite repressive and even persecutory of Protestants and other people. And so they were reacting against that in many ways. But in the American situation, it was quite different. It was more of an alliance between Enlightenment thinkers like Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin with religious people, Christians in particular. They saw common interests in the importance of religious freedom and free scholarship in science. And so they allied together, and that's what actually brought about our American independence and freedom.
Well, the religious practices of the time were very important. You mentioned the intertwining of religion and monarchies to basically maintain social order. So there was some good that came out of this clash in the sense that the social order started to look at individual rights and the common, the greater good, if you will.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I guess part of the argument of this book is that faith helps to purify reason, and reason helped to purify faith in the 1700s, and I can give you an example of each. Reason affected faith by giving sort of a rational basis to faith and devotion. So, God is the God of reason, and His world, His creation, is orderly, and we can understand it by observation and scientific procedure. Carl Linnaeus was the great Swedish naturalist who did this in his book System of Nature, which begins with a psalm praising God for the reasonability of creation. And this vision influenced Lewis and Clark and other people in our country. So you have reason purifying faith, sort of, you know, eliminating superstition and certain kinds of dangerous fanaticism from faith that we see as a major theme of the Enlightenment. But on the flip side, we also see faith purifying reason. And a good example there is the slave market, the international slave market that was led by the British Empire. You know, this was coming to great prominence in the 1700s, and often it was justified as reasonable, quote unquote, because it seemed necessary for the sugar industry and things, and it's how labor was had always been done. But Christians came along, particularly in Britain, led by John Wesley and others in the British Parliament, like Wilberforce, and they joined forces and they created really the first abolitionist movement that led to the end of slavery in the British Empire eventually. And that all started in the late Enlightenment period as an example of how faith was helping to purify reason.
Well, let's go to the just before the blooming of the Enlightenment, to Galileo and the confrontation he had with the Catholic Church over whether the earth revolved around the sun or vice versa. The religious authority had to come to terms with what was the truth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's this kind of refining process that I'm talking about. So it's sort of like when you go to the gym and you're exercising, you're putting your muscles under tension. When faith and reason are kept in sort of a healthy tension like that, people realize, oh, yeah, you know what, maybe the Bible, you know, shouldn't just be interpreted literally when it comes to questions of, like, how the nature works, and that was Galileo's point. And they both corrected each other, and people realized, oh, yeah, Galileo was right, and during the 1700s, the Enlightenment period is when church officials began to realize, yep, okay, there's new scientific evidence showing that, yeah, Galileo was right, so we need to adjust the way that we interpret certain passages of Scripture.
Well, there were major players in the Enlightenment, and Rousseau is often pointed to as one of them. Who was he?
Jean-Jacques Rousseau, yeah, a fascinating character, and he has an entire chapter on him in this book, this is my new book here, Rethinking the Enlightenment, Faith in the Age of Reason. Chapter 2 is devoted to him. He was a nobody. I mean, he was born in Geneva, he lost his parents, and he just kind of wandered around, a failed musician. And then he had this kind of ecstatic experience in 1749, walking outside of Paris along the road, and some kind of religious experience, it seems, from his diary. And he gained an inspiration that all of creation is good, all of nature is good, that evil comes from unjust systems, not from sin. And so he began sort of this utopian kind of reconstruction of human life and government through his philosophy and also advice on parenthood and everything in between. And so he was very widely read, was really the first celebrity author of the day, and very, very controversial then and now.
Did he originate the idea that authority is derived from the consent of the governed, or was he just somebody who liked that idea too?
Yeah, so he definitely popularized it. I would say it's coming from an earlier tradition, even back to the Middle Ages with Magna Carta, and Locke, late medieval, early modern period. But he definitely popularized it, and people really latched onto that idea, and the consent of the governed became a major theme of the 1700s. That's right.
The result, a few decades after Rousseau is having this experience, all hell breaks loose in France. The state declares certain religious practices as revolts against the state and actually starts persecuting priests and monks and nuns.
That's right. And that kind of gets at what the structure of this book, Rethinking the Enlightenment. Part one is called Conflict. Part two is Engagement. And part three is Retreat. And I see these three strategies as ways that people of the time just engaged other people who are very different than themselves in a diverse culture. So sometimes it's appropriate to enter into like a political kind of struggle through conflict, right? We've seen this recently in our own country, or through apologetics or writing, you know, defending the truth of something. At other times, we need to engage each other. We need to listen to what the other person has to say and what that person's point of view and experience is. And that's this engagement strategy, much less combative and much more friendly. And then the retreat strategy is that sometimes we just need to ignore what's going on around us and pay attention to our own business and not sort of, you know, stick our hand in every little thing around us. And these are three strategies that people used back then. And so what I reflect on toward the end of the book is, okay, well, what can we learn today from how they dealt with these struggles for our own environment through conflict, engagement, and retreat?
Joseph Stewart is the program chair of history at the University of Barry. We're talking about his new book, Rethinking the Enlightenment, Faith in the Age of Reason. Before this, again, conflagration that resulted in the revolution on both sides of the Atlantic for perhaps different reasons, ultimately, we had this contest of faith traditions develop as well. We had Protestantism arise. So did the debates that revolved inevitably around what's the better religious form to follow get people talking and thinking and get them onto other ideas?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the relations between different Christian groups ever since the Reformation had been a major theme. And both sides had tried to say, okay, well, we want to create a political regime that is sort of ideologically pure in the sense that we want everybody to be of the same religion, and anybody who doesn't like it has to leave or whatever. People, they tried that for a while, and it didn't work. It didn't work too well. It created a lot of resentment and persecution and problems. And so what religious people began to realize is that, well, okay, we need to figure out actually ways to engage with each other and realize that, you know, religious identity is something distinct from civic identity. And therefore, anybody, whatever background, at the time mainly Christian but also Jew, should be able to have a kind of civil rights, even with a different religious identity. And so the Enlightenment definitely fostered that line of thinking of toward religious freedom that we now appreciate in our modern world.
Well, a couple of hundred years after the Enlightenment, what is the relevance to us in the 21st century? What things did we learn or do we employ since then that are important?
You know, a couple of things. One is that in the age of the Enlightenment is the time when everybody started drinking coffee. And coffee is a stimulant, of course, and it replaced alcohol to some degree, which everybody was, because the water wasn't safe to drink, drinking constantly back then. And so with that chemical shift, that helped to bring people together in these new places called coffee houses and open them up to each other in new ways, that coffee was a stimulant that sort of powered the Enlightenment, sort of. You could think of it that way. And reminds us, I think, of the importance of just this kind of intense face-to-face interaction and this openness to other people of diverse background that sort of wears off some of the sharp edges of our personalities interacting with many kinds of people. And the people back then called this polite sociability. And this idea of polite sociability is something I think is really valuable to us today in our own age of political contention and online sniping, that we can
yes.
Recall an age of sort of more civilized kind of human interactions that can inspire us today.
And you've got these people who are really thinking deeply, and they're not necessarily thinking in a religious sense. They're looking into their own minds. I'm thinking of Descartes, who's famously said, "I think, therefore I am," and I am an individual, and my thinking is important to me, and maybe it should be important to somebody else.
Yeah.
The rise of the philosopher. And of course, you have these salons that were taking place in Paris just before the awful Reign of Terror. Ben Franklin supposedly attended some of those and enjoyed the interaction that with people who were thinking deeply about stuff that was important to them.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you brought up the idea of the salon, because one of the chapters in this book here, Rethinking the Enlightenment, that I've just published in October, one of the chapters, chapter 6, is called Not an Ordinary Salon Girl. and this is a part about one of the great women of the Enlightenment who often get left out of the story, which is sad because there were many incredible ladies who were part of this story. But Maria Agnesi was an Italian woman who is part of part 2 of this book, which is on the Catholic Enlightenment, a woman of deep faith and a woman of profound reason and science. In her family's salon in the city of Milan, she would regularly get up to perform lectures and along with her sister who played music in the background, and she would lecture on science and philosophy and mathematics, and she's actually the first woman to write a book on mathematics in history. So she's a great lady who's been forgotten, and what I've tried to do is to bring her story and the stories of other great women of the Enlightenment, like Laura Bassi, who was a physicist, and Anna Morandi, who was an anatomist, bring their stories, their relation of faith and reason in their lives, back into our knowledge through this book.
Well, you also go into some detail about the experience of a group of Carmelite nuns. Who were the Carmelite nuns, and why are they important in terms of rethinking the Enlightenment?
So these 16 women have become famous since their age as Carmelites, women who lived a quiet life of prayer, devoted to God, and they got into trouble during the French Revolution because of their monastic life, which had been made illegal by the government, and they continued to practice it, and so they were put on trial, and they were put on trial in a courtroom that was known as the Courtroom of Liberty, ironically, because it definitely wasn't reflecting religious liberty, but anyway, they were sentenced to death as traitors. And what was amazing about their story is that they went to the guillotine, as many other thousands did during the French Revolution, but they did so peacefully and even singing along the roads of Paris. As they're going through the streets, people just sort of fell silent watching these women being taken through the streets, and they were singing the Psalms, they were singing the Salve Regina, and a peace descended upon the scene as they approached the guillotine, and they kept singing the divine office that monastics sing. Even as they were walking up the steps and each head was being lopped off, one less voice singing, and everybody just sort of in awe, in sort of utter silence, watching this unfold. And I was attracted to this story because it gave just sort of a poignant background to this notion of conflict, that there was a conflict between sort of religion and this sort of totalitarian French Revolution, at least at that stage it was, and how their witness sort of lives on into the importance of limiting government and the importance of religious freedom. I think their testimony stands up.
Was that period a time of an anti-Christian period? What I'm getting at here was the turmoil in the streets more about the unholy alliance, if you will, on occasion between the church and state? Or was it against the idea of the church?
Yeah, that's great. I think it initially started out against this unholy alliance of altar and state. And yeah, then there was plenty of justification for that. I mean, it was sound reasoning on their part. This idea of separation church and state is an important one. Actually, has deep Christian roots back to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God by Jesus. That had been sort of lost, and so church and state, yeah, had become quite close together. This caused a lot of problems, and justifiably people were upset about it. But it morphed in the radical stage of the French Revolution and became much more about, just anti-Christian per se, and a hatred of religion per se, and that, I think, is where that essential clash was between these nuns and the French state.
In a blurb for your book, I read a sentence that caught my eye, and the blurb writer refers to this as our own anti-Christian age, that is, the time we live in now. What is anti-Christian?
It's a good question. I think, different threats to religious freedom that can be seen in, I don't know, the last 10 or 20 years, you know, whether it's different religious orders who are getting caught up in like the healthcare laws, you know, and mandates about that, that might violate certain ethical norms that those sisters have, those kinds of things. And then I think, you know, just, you know, anything that's anti-human is ultimately anti-Christian, because Christianity stands up for the dignity of humanity. Jesus became human. And so anytime, you know, whether it's drug abuse or whether, you know, it's racism, I mean, these are anti-human and anti-Christian things. And I think maybe that's what the blurb was getting at.
Well, sometimes we sort of oversimplify things as either Christian or secular, and secular humanist is, of course, a term that gets thrown around as somebody who thinks that there are some things that are just innately right or wrong, whether or not they were written in a book of theology or not. So how do we struggle with that tension in the 21st century? What makes a secular humanist anti-Christian, or is that even possible?
Yeah. Boy, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that if people can figure out how to look for common ground. I mean, in the Enlightenment, what this looked like was that the deists, you know, people like Franklin and Jefferson and even William Clark on the Lewis and Clark expedition. I mean, these guys were very good at different kinds of friendships. They were all deists. But each of them had friendships with different Christian peoples. And so I think that's a key to sort of lessening some of this kind of conflict that happens. And if people can just remember this kind of coffee house culture that I mentioned too, of this openness and engagement, I think that can help too.
We have talked about the separation of church and state that we celebrate today, and we try to maintain, but it seems that the hierarchy of the church, you know, Pope and Archbishop and Cardinal and all of that, is replicated by government. We've got premiers or presidents and mayors and governors and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
The difference is how they become premier or president, as opposed to, I guess I'm splitting a hair there because the popes were voted for, are voted on these days. But what I'm getting at is that the government is kind of a model of that historical tradition.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in our own American society, we look back to the founding Enlightenment period, and we can see, that there was a clear distinction. You have churchmen and you have statesmen, but they figured out that they could have a common sort of alliance around this idea of separation of church and state, which was really unusual. Actually, because in most of history, all the way back to the Roman emperors, who were considered the high priests of the ancient religion, the ancient kings and emperors and things, religion and politics always went together. But there's something quite different about Western civilization in particular, America in even more particular, that has to do with certain political and Enlightenment reasons, but also, frankly, just this idea of Christianity that God and Caesar are not the same thing. And we need to be loyal to both, it is, to the extent that we can, and that's a tension. And it is within that tension, however, between loyalty to church and loyalty to state, is found a freedom of the individual. And then we can see that emerge in the Magna Carta all the way up to our own American founding.
Joseph Stewart is the program chair of history at the University of Mary and the author of the new book, Rethinking the Enlightenment, Faith in the Age of Reason. Thank you for helping me scratch the surface of some very deep and important thinking, Joseph.
You're welcome. Thank you, Doug. Thank you so much.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll continue our discussions about healthcare during the pandemic with Dr. Matt Eaton, the Director of Dental Services at Family Healthcare Clinic in Fargo. And then Sue Balcom will join us to talk about, well, honey on Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Twin Cities-based Target has posted surging earnings for its third quarter. That, as the retailer says, it's pivoting toward a new model of retailing during the COVID-19 pandemic. Target posted a 10% gain in some stores for the quarter ending October 31st. Its digital sales nearly doubled. Target CEO Brian Cornell says the plan to turn its stores into local order fulfillment centers is paying off, even as traditional shoppers keep coming in.
Altogether, between same-day services and packages shipped to our guests, about 75% of our third quarter digital sales were fulfilled by our stores.
Other national retailers have been struggling despite reporting growth in digital sales. A Northwestern Minnesota state senator says he disagrees with Governor Walz on his latest shutdown order. Senator Kent Eakin of Twin Valley, a Democrat, like the governor, says there should be more of a regional approach when it comes to border cities.
If we have such different approaches, you know, just across the river, that we're not going to achieve the health benefits that we're seeking. Because if we're closing down bars and restaurants in Moorhead and Dilworth and so on, but they're open across the border in Fargo, people are just going to go across the border.
Eakin says he also believes that the legislature should have more input on the business closing decisions. Bars, restaurants, fitness centers, bowling alleys, and theaters are among the businesses facing a month-long shutdown. Takeout and delivery will still be allowed. And North Dakota's airports are seeing more passenger boardings as air travel continues to slowly recover from the hit the industry took as the coronavirus pandemic began. The State Aeronautics Commission reports 47,574 passenger boardings in the month of October. State Aeronautics Commission Director Kyle Wanner says that's 47% of the passengers that flew last year at this time. Wanner says this is the highest monthly demand in airline passengers since the pandemic began last spring.
That's obviously a good sign. We'll have to wait to see if it continues or if it plateaus, but we're moving in the right direction.
Wanner says he thinks November and December will show even better numbers.
Obviously, we're starting to get into holiday travel season, and we know that a lot of people won't be traveling this year, but some people still will. And so, our airports are obviously there, and the airlines, have great ticket prices. We're at a close to a 10-year low in domestic airline fares. And so, if you want to buy tickets right now at a good price, over the last 10 years, this is a good time to do that.
Wanner says airlines are also adding back flights to and from North Dakota. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Election results show that the U.S. is more sharply divided than ever between urban and rural areas. What can the Biden administration do to win over small-town communities that voted for President Trump?
The American family farmer and rancher are going away. And the parties that can figure out how to stop that from happening will win rural America.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Yesterday on our show, we talked with Dr. Kenzie Nelson. He's the head of medical services at the Family Health Care Center in Fargo. And today, we're talking with Dr. Matt Eaton, who is the director of dental services for that organization. Dr. Eaton, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Are people foregoing dental visits during the pandemic?
Doug, I think some are. I think it depends on your level of risk. We've had lots of changes during this pandemic season. I think most of us experienced, a shutdown, and that probably ranged a little bit by how long it was, by what state you were in. In North Dakota, most people had a shutdown of dental services for about 6 weeks, and that was a little bit longer than that in Minnesota for routine care. And so as I think most dental offices have come back, it really is dependent on office policy as well as, a person's own health risks and, what kind of close contacts they've had on how they're getting back in to see the dentist.
Family health care is where you work. Is your job different? What extra precautions might you take now in terms of dealing with a patient face-to-face? Because you literally are face-to-face when you're providing these services.
Right. And so it would be different depending on where we are in the pandemic. During the shutdown, we had changed our clinic primarily to a urgent needs clinic, as we felt compelled by our safety net nature. But in returning to more routine care, the biggest differences you will see will be, as you first come through the door, screening questions as you first ask whether, how sick you are, what type of symptoms you've had. Possibly you'll see temperature checks. And, now you're going to start to see more plastic barriers to help protect front reception workers, as well as them wearing PPE. To them, as you come back for your appointment, you're going to see much more protective equipment worn by providers, you know, as well as N95 masks and face shields, and a lot of air purification systems that have been added.
Do you feel that your job is more dangerous, if you will, now because of these circumstances?
I feel that we have taken proper precautions to help limit the risks. You know, whether it's the masks that we wear, along with the face shields, along with the filtration systems, that we have really tried to spare no expense to make sure that our employees are protected as we see them, and to take those extra effects to make sure that patients are protected. You know, the novel coronavirus is very contagious and can be scary, but I feel as safe as I can be to practice, you know, where we are working now. And additionally, I understand that this is the field that I chose, and I, you know, love helping people with dentistry, and so I'm willing to take on some of that risk, but, you know, that might change for different people depending on, you know, their own personal health conditions.
For people who don't have insurance or the means to pay, and that's a significant portion of the people who are dealt with at the Family Healthcare Center, are they more likely to have serious dental issues?
What we do see from a population-based aspect is that, you know, patients in that lowest 20% of the socioeconomic bracket tend to have about 80% of the caries. So, and there might be a number of reasons for that. You know, traditionally we know that dental care is expensive. And so it may be that at times that, you know, those patients have avoided care, and so therefore cavities have gotten bigger. And so we do see a lot of patients that come to Family Health Care, you know, may need, you know, larger fillings, or they may have more extractions that they need in the population that we serve.
There are some risks for not getting regular dental care, aren't there? I mean, isn't the health of the mouth sometimes related to health elsewhere in the body?
Absolutely. You know, so we see that when teeth aren't taken care of and teeth become infected, you know, that, you know, infection leads to other, you know, places in the body. You know, we also have started to link where, you know, patients with gum disease generally have, you know, higher amounts of inflammation and poor diabetic control. And so, yeah, when we treat a person, you know, we do want to understand that it's not just the mouth that we're treating, but, you know, it's an entire patient, and, you know, there's other systems affected as well.
Now, there have been some very significant advances in dentistry in my lifetime, I can tell you that. I mean, from false teeth and bridges now to implants. What's the limit in terms of helping somebody who needs help, who is in the safety net, that, you know, lowest percentile in terms of income of the patients you deal with? How far can you go in giving something to them that will be a solution for the long term, like an implant, for example?
We pride ourselves on being able to provide all of the treatment options, and the options that we can't provide, you know, have referrals to, you know, work with different specialists.
Well, oftentimes medical insurance doesn't include dental coverage. Your hands are tied in terms of some more permanent or better solution?
You know, we pride ourselves here at Family Healthcare in being able to offer patients the highest quality of services. Many of our patients are limited on how much their insurance will cover. So typically with, you know, most of our Medicaid program, which we see many patients of, they're limited to extractions and fillings and partial dentures or full dentures, and can have still great treatment outcomes and restore their smile and get back up to the workforce. But when we do start to see some of these other procedures, such as implants and bridges, we start to see many of them aren't covered. And those services, even when we look at from a commercial dental standpoint, we see that they are more expensive than what typical patients' yearly benefit is. And so many times that they don't elect to, you know, utilize those procedures, but occasionally we do have patients that do that.
How did you find your way into this kind of practice? I had an old friend. His dental practice was exclusively to those people who were just too poor to have regular dental care, you know, through the normal channels, people with insurance. What drew you to this kind of practice?
Well, two things I really dug. As I went to dental school at the University of Minnesota, and as I was going through rotations there, had the ability to experience different types of clinics, and, you know, was always drawn, I was always most about just trying to help people. And then in leaving school, you know, I was actually directed towards a community health center because of some loan repayment opportunities. And so initially I had moved to Wisconsin to follow those opportunities and found that I really enjoyed this type of practice and the people that I could help. But eventually drawn back towards Fargo, North Dakota, where I grew up. And so 5 years into having kids and working, it was time to come back to the Fargo-Moorhead area for me.
These days, we're hearing a lot about telehealth because, obviously, that's one way to protect both the patient and the provider from a pandemic virus. How would a dentist use telehealth? Is it me calling you on the phone saying, my tooth really hurts, I need to see somebody right now? Or can you do more, you know, in-depth analysis of what somebody might need?
I think telehealth in dentistry is difficult. We attempted it during the pandemic to a small degree. And so in dentistry, you know, the way I think that it's best utilized is a screening to help, you know, patients can show a picture of their tooth. They've got a cavity. You know, what problem might I have? You know, if there's good evidence that there's an infection, possibly a dentist over the phone can help prescribe an antibiotic. But most of dentistry involves, you know, some type of surgical component, whether it's cutting your tooth or, you know, to put a filling in or removing a tooth. So I think there's definite limitations with telehealth in dentistry.
We look forward to a time when that pandemic, that COVID-19, is an additional barrier to getting routine dental care. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Dr. Matt Eaton is the Director of Dental Services for Family Healthcare in Fargo. Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats to talk about honey.
For a lot of us, the holidays are going to be a bit different this year. Many people will be separated from their loved ones for the first time and will have to rely on things like Zoom and FaceTime. Others are paring down their usual big family gatherings. But whatever the case, people are finding innovative ways to safely spend time together. So, what about you? What's your plan for the holidays? We would love to hear about it. Call us at 701-428-1686 and record your story. And hey, you might even inspire someone else to celebrate creatively this holiday season and spread some much-needed cheer. That number again is 701-428-1686. Call us and tell us your name, where you live, and your holiday plans and ideas, and we'll share them on the air and online. Whatever and however you celebrate, we at Prairie Public wish you a safe, happy, and healthy holiday season.
Hi, well, I see trees of green and red roses too.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and root cellar Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is so much fun, and this is about as public as I get these days.
How far into your holiday baking are you already?
Okay, well, here's the deal. I have to get started like ASAP. I have tons of orders for Pfeffernusse. Mm. And Pfeffernusse are always better when they're aged. So that is on my list of priorities in the next few days to do. And so, speaking of Pfeffernusse and cookies, you know, everybody has to think about what's available this time of year in abundance. And honey is one of those wonderful things that you can get now, and you should always get it from a local farmer.
It tastes better. It really does.
It's better for you to buy local honey, mostly because the bees that are around your property, well, okay, not everybody's property, but my bees eat what's available around my place or around even a central area in North Dakota. And then that way, they say that if you eat local honey, it helps with allergies because the pollen helps you build up your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
from the pollen that the birds, I mean, the bees eat.
So
not
are
the
you,
birds
are
and the
you
bees.
Trying
That's a different
to pitch
subject.
Immune-boosting pfeffernuss to us? Is this what I'm hearing?
Oh, yeah. There you go. I love that. I'm going to have to do that. But, you know,
yeah, let's find a funder for this study.
Right. In addition to that, my grandmother always made honey cookies at Christmas time. And I posted that recipe online one time, and somebody's like, oh, I thought honey was supposed to be the sugar substitute. This thing has tons of sugar and tons of honey. And I'm like, I know, right?
It's called a cookie.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
And they were always perfectly shaped. There's a trick to that, cooking those honey cookies, baking those honey cookies and those pfeffernuss. We have too much flour, then they get hard as a rock, not enough flour, and they faint if they're not baked properly. But hers were always perfect, and they had this white, like royal frosting on them and lots of little sprinkles, and they were so good. I don't make them very often, but I was thinking about digging that honey. Somebody gifted me a couple cases of honey that I'm sure that they thought was not good. However, honey never spoils.
Yeah.
It gets crystally and it gets a little dark and colored sometimes, but all you need to do is steam it in a pan with lots of hot water. You know, you can put it in a double boiler, or else when I when I can something, I have leftover hot water, so I just set it on the rack and warm it up, and then it's perfectly good to use. So I was like, the cost of honey nowadays is very pricey, as you use as much as I do, and so I was just delighted with this gift. But honey and the holidays, perfect combination. There are so many wonderful ways to use honey, like in glazing your ham, your holiday ham. And that's simply making honey and a little bit of corn syrup and maybe a couple spices and some butter mixed up together. And then while your ham is baking, you just go into the oven and brush that baby up. And when it comes out, it'll be just dripping sweet and caramel colored, because like sugar, honey will darken when you cook it. A lot of times that can burn easy, so you kind of have to watch it. But, oh, my gosh. And then, oh, yay. What do you want me to bring for Thanksgiving? Homemade buns. Absolutely. And then you can make that cinnamon butter with the honey in it for on those buns. That's just so wonderful. And it's fairly simple, too. You just simply whip up some butter. Whoop it up, depending on how strong your mixer is, and then add some honey, drizzle honey into it, and mix that thoroughly, and then you can spice it up with cinnamon. I love nutmeg. Nutmeg is my holiday spice.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And it's perfect, you know, not only for buns, but like on your squash or whatever else you want to cook that you want to sweeten up and spice up a little bit.
It's also kind of a nice little party favor. Yeah, I've had it given to me, honey butter. It's kind of wonderful to leave the meal with a little gift like that, because it keeps on giving.
Well, and that is a tradition that I wonder if people have forgotten about. We never went to anybody's house, and still don't, without bringing a hostess gift. Of course, we didn't call it that, but
just a little
but that's a. Yeah, that's a good idea. And you can buy these beautiful weak jars, W-E-C-K, online at Amazon. They're pricey, but they're so gorgeous. And I think honey butter in one of those would be a wonderful gift for a school teacher, your pastor, you know, somebody that you just want to appreciate, which we are coming up on Thanksgiving, and that's time to be appreciative and time to eat more food, you know, like honey roasted carrots.
Yes.
Or honey sweetened squash. I actually just dug my carrots not too long ago. I love roasted vegetables, and found this recipe for honey roasted carrots, which makes them even better, even though carrots are sweet. So you do it basically the same way, but you use a little bit of honey to glaze again, and bourbon if you want.
Well, thank you.
To glaze them with a brush. Well, you know, honey and bourbon and honey and, you know, it's cold season, right?
Yeah.
And what's better for a sore throat than honey?
These
are great cold remedies. Right. Honey and lemon juice, honey and lemon vodka. I don't know. Whatever whatever you feel, you know, okay with doing. So, but you should
if we're all
always...
working from home and you don't have to, you don't have to drive. I'm kidding.
Hey, that is an advantage to that, isn't that? Yeah. Well, anyway, so, so there you go. You've got almost something for every meal. You've got your, or every part of your meal. You've got your buns and honey butter. You've got your ham glazed. You've got your carrots glazed. You've got your squash sweetened. You can make the most fabulous salad dressings with honey.
Yeah.
Totally. Yep. Totally yeah, love honey and balsamic vinegar mixed together with a couple spices.
I like a lot of grilled cheeses with honey too.
Ooh, yeah. I've never had
that
a grilled
sound good,
cheese.
Yeah. I could do that.
It is.
Technical question here, Sue. When I make glazed carrots, I usually use brown sugar. If I were using honey, would it be the same process, or is there a different temperature, a different process? I mean, do I just put it on and get it hot?
Yep, that's what I would do. Now, if your carrots are huge, so that they would cook longer than... you know, 20 minutes at a really hot oven gives you a really good crisp vegetable. So if there are large carrots, I would trim them down a little bit or cut them into sticks. I have customers that are looking for those long, skinny carrots, and I grow the fat kind all the time. So I have to cut mine up a little bit. But carrot coins, right? But yes, basically you could do the same thing for that. I've never tried it with potatoes, but I know it works squash really well to do that glazed thing.
And with baking, you use just a little bit less than, it's not quite a one-to-one ratio, right, with sugar?
Actually, there is, yes, you have to kind of like substitute your honey, but since honey is a liquid and sugar is not, you use a little less honey, but you add a little bit more take out some of the liquids also when you're doing that. And then you lower your oven temperature because honey will burn a little bit faster than sugar. Mm. And a little secret here, just add a little baking soda to some of those baking recipes so that you're lightening the load a little bit. You know, the honey is a little bit heavier viscosity-wise than sugar would be. And so your sugar in your liquids is lighter than your honey. So then you want to add a little baking soda. That would act as a leavening ingredient in there. And you can experiment a little bit with that. But honey is a pretty powerful sweetener. And I never liked it when I was young. And I don't know what happened because I could drink it now. Whoa. And honey is amazing because there are other honeys that I never knew about till I went down to Savannah, Georgia. And I went to a honey tasting. I had a flight of honey, like you have a flight of beer at a store. And it was so great because there's wormwood honey, which is bitter. And there's Tupelo honey, which is unbelievable. Then there's orange blossom honey. And all of these different things that the bees eat change the flavor of the honey. Now, we use, you know, sweet clover up here is basically what our bees eat. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you ever get a chance to sample some of those other honeys, they are amazing.
Next week, we're going to talk about the big holiday that's coming up. The one that used to be everybody gathered around the table will probably be a little different this time around. But meanwhile, it's the sweet season, the holiday season. So honey's a great thing to talk about. Sue, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, guys. That's my pleasure. Thank you.
It's Main Street Eats, and you'll hear it again next week with Sue Balcom. Dakota Datebook is next.
Coming up on Prairie Mosaic, we'll visit a unique island home, watch as science and art become pottery, learn about Scandinavian folk art, and listen to area musicians play some smooth jazz on the next Prairie Mosaic.
Watch an all-new Prairie Mosaic tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 19th. Erosion is constant in Theodore Roosevelt National Park, where the colorful but crumbly badlands are on full display.
a scenic loop rings the park's south unit at Medora, taking visitors through prairie dog towns, river bottomland, and layered bluffs. The park was established in 1947 as Theodore Roosevelt National Memorial Park, but the 21-mile loop wasn't completed until 1968, when the final 7 miles of road were laid. Visitors previously had to retrace the road from Wind Canyon and Buck Hill. U.S. Senator Quentin Burdick and Congressman Tom Kleppe helped dedicate the last segment that fall. The senator observed, "There is a rapidly growing population in this nation with more and more free time to see the beautiful land. North Dakota is blessed with the most wondrous sights anywhere, and roads such as this enable these people to visit these sites." Kleppe added that the project was another step in advancing North Dakota tourism, which today is the state's third largest industry. The park superintendent and a U.S. Department of Interior official also spoke. First Lady Jean Guy cut a ribbon at the ceremony. About 400 people attended. Bismarck police on horseback made a presentation of colors, and a motorcade of dignitaries led the way back to Medora. The new roadway didn't last long. Bismarck Tribune readers on this date learned of a landslide blocking 250 feet of the east section of the new road, barely 4 months after it was completed. 6 months later, a Dickinson Construction Company won the contract for repair of the road, which reopened in time for the 4th of July. The Badlands continued to challenge the park's roads. In the spring of 2019, a slump from erosion carried away a section of road near the Badlands Overlook. Afterwards, several sinkholes and road movement also affected the road near the Ridgeline Nature Trail and Scoria Point Overlook. Repairs are ongoing. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In times of uncertainty, conversation can be a sustaining light. I'm Helga Davis, and on my show, I have inspiring conversations with people you may recognize, like the host of On Being, Krista Tippett, and Grammy Award-winning bassist, Esperanza Spalding. Join me for a special broadcast of Helga.
Helga, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
Whether you listen to us over the air or online, thanks for joining us today for Main Street. And a reminder that you can find any Main Street show after it's been on the air or online at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, Rich LeMay, Executive Director for Legal Assistance of North Dakota, will join us to talk about the pandemic's effect on the demand for services to deal with issues like evictions and bankruptcies. News Director Dave Thompson will join us to talk about the week's big stories, as he does every Friday. And Matt Olin will review a new documentary about a North Dakota controversy, Fighting Over Sioux. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.